In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Who are you?
Bond. James Bond.
Oh, Draco.
Yes, who is it?
Bond. James Bond.
Thank God, James.
Good evening. My name is Bond. James Bond.
Who are you?
Bond. James Bond.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
The next best Bond debut of Timothy Dalton in The Living Daylights. I mean, this is one of our favourite films in the whole series. And Timothy Dalton, his history with the franchise goes way back because he was asked to audition when Sean Connery left the role ahead of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Because I think he'd just been in The Line of Winter, which is obviously a massive success and Oscar-nominated, Oscar-winning, I think. In fact, I think, did John Barry might have won an Oscar for that? But anyway, he said, Timothy Dalton said, he was too young. He was only 25 then. And imagine the pressure on a 25-year-old, never mind George at 29, succeeding Sean as Bond. And he did later sort of dwell on that when he was interviewed for the role in Living Daylights. And he said he thinks Bond should be between 35 and 40. So there you go. And as a 25 to 26-year-old, he wouldn't have been right. In 85... You know, apparently A View to a Kill was a disappointment. I mean, I don't agree with that. Work began on the scripts for the next Bond film. Now, I know this did say that the intention was they didn't think Roger would reprise the role. He's sort of unofficially retired, and he would have been 59 when they came to film it. I think talking with John Glenn and reading around a lot of the scripts with The Living Daylights, it wasn't written for Timothy Dalton, but it sort of gradually morphed into something. So there are sort of elements which are almost leftovers from the Roger era that you occasionally see in the script. But the finished product, you could never argue that it was I don't think another actor could have done it personally. The way it's done by Tim is fantastic. But of course, before we got Tim, we had the absolute mess, really, with Pierce Brosnan. There was a massive search for Bond actors then. It wasn't quite as clear-cut as when Roger got it, that he was definitely going to take over. You had Sam Neill, and you can see his audition online. Again, the famous Tatiana Romanova scene. Pierce Brosnan, of course, we'll go on to him. He and Timothy Dalton, all three of them did an audition in 86. But all three of them were really considered and sold, apart from Cubby, who wasn't sold on Sam Neill. And Sam Neill himself said he never wanted the role. But he could say that now, can't he? Financial backers were MGM still, and they recommended Mel Gibson. I mean, that sounds silly now, perhaps, but in the 80s, back then, I mean, he was absolutely incredible, really charismatic. I think, personally, would have been quite good. Fairly small, though. People don't realise that. But, again, when we spoke to John Glenn, he still says, I think John Glenn would... I think Mel Gibson would have been terrific in the role. That was a possibility, but he was far too expensive. So it was never going to happen. There was still that kind of idea that you want a British person playing James Bond at that stage. Plenty of other people were in the frame. when we spoke to Mariam Darbo, she did the screen test with Lambert Wilson, the French actor. He looks the part, certainly. He looks very Bond, but it wasn't to be. Perhaps he wasn't quite British enough. So the producers did eventually turn to Brosnan after another three-day screen test. But of course, then, if you don't know the story, he was contracted to this TV series in America called Remington Steel. But then it was cancelled due to falling ratings. So this was like, brilliant, right? There we go. It was announced that he was going to be Bond. And you can see the pictures of John Glenn Cubby signing the deal, ready to start filming. The problem with that, though, was that caused a surge in interest for Remington Steel because it was still being shown. They then thought, oh, right, no, let's sort of seize upon this and do another series. So that led to a sort of break clause in Brosnan's contract to make a further series. And you know what Cubby was like then. He's not going to say, oh, we'll wait another year or something. We've got to get on with this Bond film now. So the offer was withdrawn. Ironically, that led to a drop in interest in Remington Steel. And so only five more episodes were filmed and it was cancelled. So he could have done it. What must it have been like for Brosnan? It must have been awful, really.
I mean, it must be on many different levels, just really, just terrible. One, from a professional, I think I can't remember how many seasons of Remington Steel they've been at that point, but I think it's, if you know it's going down and it's not going to go back, I think maybe he was ready. And I think based on, you know, interviews and whatever else that he said, I think you kind of hear that anyway. And just, I think he was ready to, and I think something like Bond was like the next natural progression for him. And instead that's halted, you know, of course he gets the role in the end, but, you know, it's waiting 9 years, which is a really long time. But yeah, I think on a personal level, it's kind of just like, oh, it's the last possible reason. There's so many shows that don't get picked up, that don't make next season. You know, you see it nowadays, people do petitions and all the large, you know, noise to get a show, you know, put back on the air, and it doesn't work. And the fact that this, to say that maybe it was only Bond that could have potentially got this show back, and then it doesn't even work out anyway. It would have been different if the show worked out, but it didn't. But no, I would have been devastated, and I would have felt like that was the only opportunity, because once you've got into that moment, how do you ever get that back? You have no idea how long the next person is going to do it, or what the landscape's going to be like in the 90s. You know, how's Bond going to be? Is this something that would even be? So I can just imagine at that point, and he says it in the Everything or Nothing documentary, he says like, right, that's it. Like, I thought that was it. We're glad that it wasn't. But luckily, it's not the end of the world, and it wasn't.
Absolutely right. I mean, we'll now sort of go into who was cast, and it was Tim. Basically, when that happened, they went then definitely Dalton, and it was Dana Broccoli who said, yes, let's go with him. Cubby apparently was a bit worried because Dalton wasn't sort of clamouring for the part. You know, he's not one of these guys who's going to publicly say, yes, I'd love to be Bond. Dana basically said, Cubby, you need to meet with him. And then the same thing happened again. So Dalton was filming this film called Brenda Starr. I don't know if anyone's seen that, but I've not seen it. So he was unavailable. And then luckily for him, in the intervening period, having completed the film, he had a gap in his schedule. So he was offered the role, and this time he was like, yes, I'm going to go for it. Does anyone know Robert Bathurst, the actor who was in Cold Feet, amazingly? The sort of more well-spoken one. You probably don't know him, Charlie, but he's on English TV screens. But he was apparently auditioned. But even he said he thinks it was just an arm-twisting exercise to get Tim to sort of say yes. They've got to say, they did it with Roger, didn't they? No, we're still auditioning. We're still auditioning. You know, if you want to come back, you need to do it soon. So I think that's why they did it. Tim basically said yes. Dick Maybaum was very happy with the choice, and I think that's partly because he could sort of factor the scripts more to them. As we know, Tim famously said, doesn't he wants to go back to the Fleming, and he particularly favoured the first three Bond films. They're his favourites. And he wanted to sort of... You have to do it differently, don't you? It's not saying Roger Moore's way of doing Bond is bad, but there's no point trying to do Roger Moore, is there? Because it's not what he's good at. And so they did turn back to this sort of more Fleming style, particularly with the story. The first half especially is so Cold War espionage. And I think personally it's the perfect film for him to be introduced. So Charlie, just Can you remember the moment that Tim was announced as Bond?
Actually, no. I do not remember. Right. I don't remember any of the publicity around Bond's being announced. Yeah, I was seeing the movies, you know, first run in the theater. Like I said, I pretty much everything since Live and Let Die I saw in the theater. But yeah, I honestly do not remember the hype. I remember vaguely the Pierce Brosnan, you know, kerfuffle with him being considered for the role and then becoming unavailable. But yeah, I don't really remember. It was really, my first memory is his introduction in the film.
And that's what an entrance that is. I mean, what more can you want? I think even now, I'm glad it's still being talked about, as the really famous one is, of course, in Dr. No, but this is probably the second most heralded now, isn't it? The way that the music crescendos, and of course the exercise in Gibraltar, it's loads of different 00 agents. If you look at the behind-the-scenes shots, he is on the plane. You can see Dalton is one of the guys who jumps out, of course. Well, the stuntman did it. But he's in that scene with M.
Gentlemen, this may only be an exercise so far as the Ministry of Defence is concerned. But for me, it is a matter of pride that the 00 section has been chosen for this test. Your objective is to penetrate the radar installations of Gibraltar. Now, the SAS have been placed on full alert to intercept you, but I know you won't let me down. Good luck, men.
To know that, he's going to be revealed as one of the agents when he turns around. And of course, it's when the rogue agent has revealed himself and killed one of them. It's just, I mean, I think it's one of the best, if not the best, pre-title sequence. But that moment, was it, were you sold on him, Charlie, as Bond?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And thinking about, I watched Living Daylights and GoldenEye since last week. I was thinking, sort of doing a comparison to the Lazenby intro. I may have mentioned something about this then, but you know, the George Lazenby intros, they start with these close-ups of him, you know, lighting a cigarette in the car and, you know, putting a cigarette in his mouth and everything. And so you're sort of seeing close-up bits and pieces of him. In a way, this one's the opposite, where you're seeing these three anonymous people, you know, with their backs towards you in the M's office scene in the plane. And then you see them in silhouette, you see them, you know, skydiving. And then, you know, the lead up is you see what happens to the first two agents. And then, as you say, the music builds and you see that wonderful shot of him snapping his head around as he hears the other agent screaming and falling to his death.
That's it, chum. You're out of it.
Yeah, there's something about the way they frame that shot, the music, the gesture of his snapping his head around and looking to see the source of the sound. It's really, really beautifully done. I think for me, it just really cemented him in the role on the basis of those first few minutes of film.
And he's so hands-on, isn't he? He's involved in the action. He's on the top of that Jeep. It's just, it's pure exhilaration. And I really hope we can get an introduction like that for our next. That would be the sort of litmus test that I would go for.
Game's up, mate. You're dead.
It was weird, actually, because when I got all of the tapes, the only Bonds that I'd never seen at that point were George and Tim.
No!
And George had slotted in between Connery and Moore. I felt more comfortable with that, whereas I feel like Roger Moore's era and Brosnan's are so different visually that it was kind of weird seeing for the first time this branch between them where you kind of get this, you know, serious Bond, you know, because, you know, Brosnan and Moore, for as dark as they can be, are mostly quite light. So it took a while for me to really enjoy the Dalton films. Not that I didn't at all, but they were some of the last ones I saw out of all of them. And I think when you have your favourites, it's very difficult, unless you've completely blown away. And License to Kill was a bit too, at that age, 10, 11 years old, it's a bit too much for you. And Living Daylights felt a bit weird. And I think it could have been based on what was going on script-wise, because I know there probably was elements that they brought over, that, you know, ideas and stuff that had been brought over from a Moore era.
Here, hold on, you're dead.
Mixing in some other elements as they kind of tried to figure out who Bond is, and that's completely natural and completely appreciate that. And you know, you see it. I mean, everyone knows the magic carpet deleted scene and all that, which I would love to see Roger do that. I just think that would have been so funny, but it would have been wrong to have that in Living Daylights. And as much as people might have got a laugh out of it, I think it would have taken away from his performance, which is so strong and so serious the entire film. As you get older, you can look at things from a different perspective, and I do look at Dalton's era completely differently. As much as, you know, I can't say Living Daylights is my favourite. License to Kill is in my top 10, and Living Daylights has so many amazing things about it anyway, and I think part of it is Dalton's just performance in general and his physicality, which I appreciate. I think John Ortiz has said about actors are there to act, and you've got people to do stunts, and you know that is traditionally how it is. And I agree with that, and I think there's, you know, stunt people do their work and they should be appreciated for it. However, I love when you can see the actor and you know that they're doing some of it. It makes the transitions and the cuts between the stunt person and the actor a bit easier, and you can kind of suspend your disbelief a little bit more. So when you see Dalton in that first pre-title sequence and he's on the Jeep, it makes you feel like he is at the top of Gibraltar and that he could go right off the edge at any moment. But he plays the character with such conviction that I don't think anyone else had done so before so strongly. His motivation for it really speaks for itself through what he does on screen. And so you can't fault Dalton at all. I don't think it's right to do so. And I would really like to know why people would. I can understand maybe the films and maybe this weird late 80s era where you're kind of not really sure where it's going. But they were doing something with it and they were trying out different things, which you can only applaud. Because otherwise it would have gone stale, and you can't do what Roger did before. That wouldn't have been right either.
It's such an indelible image. It was one of the first ones we actually got on video, as opposed to recording off TV. So it was almost, to us, it felt cleaner. There was no adverts. The pitch was better, the sound was better.
It's all so boring here, Margot. There's nothing but playboys and tennis pros. If only I could find a real man.
I need to use your phone. She'll call you back.
Who are you?
Bond, James Bond. Exercise Control 007 here. I'll report in an hour.
Won't you join me?
Better make that two.
We must have watched it so many times. So it was never for us, for some reason. We never had the whole Roger and Tim so different, one after each other, because they were all just watched all different times of the day. And the film is a lot of fun. You know, there's a lot of serious things in it, as with License to Kill, but there's a heck of a lot of silly things that kids love. I mean, some of the fights in it, you know, that fight that Bond isn't even in the kitchen, we just thought that was terrific. And the Baddy Milkman, who, that's what we used to call him, of course, Necros. It's just, I couldn't believe how cool this guy was and the disguises, chucking these milk bottles around and blowing up. It's weird because it's sort of painted now as one of the more traditional, like From Russia With Love, Living Daylights. We as kids absolutely loved it. And it's that, I don't know, everyone has their own different experience, don't they, with these Bond films growing up. And I just, it's the one I turn to many, many times, and I love to rewatch it.
I would say, actually, that I think you mentioned Necros, and I feel like Living Daylights and License to Kill, at least for me as a kid, like first watching them, felt more like realistic evil rather than kind of fantasy evil. You know, I was scared of the Scarecrows and Baron Samedi. I was scared of Scaramanga a little bit. I was scared of Jaws. Those things scared me, but in one way, they seemed larger than life characters. Not that Necros isn't, but he, because of him doing those things and using his headphones, because he strangles someone with headphones, he's throwing milk bottles, and he looks gorgeous, and then he's doing all of these things and he's just absolutely terrible. And I think that's what made him even scarier, which in turn makes the film a bit more dramatic, have more stakes. And it's the same with License to Kill, with Sanchez and with Dario and all of those from his team, from his group. It is very much getting onto a more mature level. Maybe Living Daylights isn't all the way there, but you can kind of see the direction it's going in, which what makes the thought of a third Dalton, which I feel like is mentioned every single time, but I think it is such an intriguing prospect for like a 1991 Bond, which is
a peak cinema, you know, that early 90s, 91 and 93. Think of the some of the action films that were coming out at that time. If you could have kept John Glenn for those as well, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows what would happen with them and the baddies they could have had. Living Daylight, you're absolutely right. And Necros, that end fight on the plane, it's the stunt work is just insane, isn't it? And it showcases Tim, because you do genuinely think, how on earth is he going to beat this guy? Because he's just, like you say, fit as a fiddle, isn't he? He's so lethal. They're on the back of a plane, for goodness sake. it still takes my breath away when I see that scene. I don't care how many times I've seen it, but is that amazing to watch still for you, Charlie?
Oh, it is, absolutely. And what was the? I remember an anecdote they were saying that the sort of the final stages when Bond is on the cargo net by himself, and most of the, you know, the most of the bags of opium are gone or whatever, that it started that rhythmic flopping, that actually wasn't, they weren't counting on that. That was a surprise to them that was happening. And so it was this sort of unexpected aspect to it. And, you know, having heard that and seeing it again, it's just an amazing scene.
I think that motion you're on about, you can see the long shots from the stuntmen. What I think one of the head nearly collided with the back, you know, it could have been killed easily. And I think they had to sort of there's so many takes where they just said, nope, just jumped off and used the parachutes because it was getting ridiculous. But you're right, they incorporated that in, didn't they? And that's how Bond that's how he gets back in, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then the thing gets caught up. But there are so many scenes in The Living Daylights which showcase Dalton. And again, another guy we spoke to, Saunders, of course, Thomas Wheatley. I mean, his character is jolly underrated, but their relationship's fascinating because Bond is being really prickly with him to start with. But that final scene when he dies, it's so well done, everything about it. You know, you've got the little bit of, I don't know, acknowledgement from Bond that actually this is a good guy, and he thanks him, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. And then just to see him smile and leave, it's so harrowing. And that reaction from Dalton.
Where's Whitaker now?
At his place in Tangier. Well done.
Good luck. Saunders. Thanks.
I don't think we've seen anything like that before, had we? That sort of real outpouring of emotion, Sam. It's just phenomenal acting, isn't it?
Yeah, there's been many times in the series up to that point where, you know, they were the sacrificial lamb, and usually it's done for the right reasons, and sometimes it's done for the wrong reasons. Sometimes it's just for the shock value or for whatever else. In this case, it's absolutely one of the best uses of it, because you need to get Bond, not back on track, but you kind of need to get him to remember what this is all about and the damage of this continuing on as is, what that could do. Saunders is just a pawn to you know, Necros at the end, which is pretty crap. Awful for sure. But, you know, it makes Bond reevaluate his mission. Because clearly he thinks it's going one way. He's just had this, you know, romantic evening with Kara, kind of thinking, oh yeah, everything's like kind of going our way. It's good. But you've just seen his face, just how angry he is. And just seeing those words on that balloon, like, you know, you've seen his actions right after where he could have, you know, shot a mother and child, you know, the lovely things you do. So it's one of those things where you just kind of go, you know, that was brilliant. And with another actor, with Sam Neill, with Brosnan, with whoever else, it might not have worked. I think in this it does work. But then, you know, you follow that up with some fantastic scenes, and then his ultimate, you know, betrayal by Kara and all of that. And it is just fantastic. Like, he is, I think, the best trained actor, you know, to become Bond. I mean, everyone knows about his background, and I think it takes someone with a lot of, you know, thoughtfulness to kind of look at a role that he's potentially being offered in 1969, 68, and just saying, you know what, I'm not right for this or whatever. This won't be right for me to do. And I appreciate that he wasn't just like, oh yeah, I'll go into this, because by this point it's a 23-year-old franchise, and you've got to be a bit skeptical of something where potentially the best has already happened. But I think what I adore about Tim Dalton is that I think he likes to change perceptions and to really put his all into it. And you see that in the performances that he does, and he can flick from being one of the funniest characters to being someone who's so serious and so maniacal. Yeah, I've got no complaints with him, and I think it's just a shame that we didn't get more. Not Roger Moore, but more. I mean, I would have more of Roger Moore and more of Tim Dalton. More of them all.
Yeah. It would have been a big thing because Roger was so well loved, wasn't he? Just to have someone new. And because he only did two, and, License to Kill wasn't as big a success as they hoped. He had been forgotten for a while as a sort of a bit of an outlier like George. You only just have to go on Bond Twitter every day and he's just praised all the time. So I do hope he knows that. We'd love to tell him, wouldn't we? One day. just how well loved he is. The average person in the street, though, I don't think they would have an awful lot to say about Tim Dalton as Bond. You know, in Partridge, Lynn, is that the Welsh one? Are those the Welsh ones? He didn't play it as a Welshman, Lynn. He didn't say, Jones the Bond.
I think about when I was a kid and what was being shown on TV, whatever else. And, Dalton and Lazenby just were not shown as much. No. Whether it was the films that were being played at that point or, this card game, you don't see their pictures straight away or they don't have a lot of screen time. Same as in the trailers, for the videos and whatnot, Connery and Moore and Brosnan got the most airtime. I can understand they had done more of the films, but I think at that point it's like you go for what the public knows, and the public knows, I would say when I was a kid, it's Connery's Bond, Moore's Bond, and Brosnan is Bond.
Yeah.
And that's what it felt like. And I think that's why it took me a bit of a longer time to get to Dalton and to actually kind of appreciate his work. Whereas Lazenby, it was more easy because it was just one, and it was so, I think 60s films just have a certain other way of look and feel about them.
Because like Roger, well, Sean and more so Roger, they were Bond in between the films. You know, whenever they were on a chat show or made a public appearance, it was like, oh, it's Bond. Whereas Tim didn't want to do those kind of appearances. And I think after License to Kill, I'm not sure, did he ever appear in an interview still as James Bond? Because he was still Bond technically for another, three or four years after that? And I remember, I was a young lad then. He was still my Bond, technically. It was only when we found out that, we were worried, of course, that that was it. There wasn't going to be any more Bond films. And a 5-year gap now isn't much, is it? But a 6-year gap. Back then, that was absolutely enormous and it was depressing. And you're almost, the 30th anniversary came and went in 92 with no new Bond on the horizon. I suppose that leads us next into Pierce because it all worked out brilliantly. And we were very sad that Tim didn't get to do 91 and 93. And he deserves to have 4 films, doesn't he? Like Pierce had and Daniel got 5. In terms of when Living Daylights came out, though, Roger said he didn't want to watch it because he was worried if he didn't like it, he wouldn't have anything positive to say about it. But I think he has said he rates Tim since. Conversely, Sam Neill thought he did really well. He thought Dalton did really well and he was a good choice. But he didn't watch it at the time because he was still a bit hurt about this. Sean Connery was a big fan of Dalton and he endorsed him, as did Desmond Llewellyn. And weirdly, their scenes together are excellent. You wouldn't have picked those two, would you, on paper perhaps? But the sort of great uncle, particularly License to Kill, it's done brilliantly.
If you're enjoying Really 007 Pod, why not follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram? Look us up. But Really 007 Pot, it'll scare the living daylights out of you.
Eventually all the legal wrangles, we won't go into all those tonight, but Pierce Brosnan finally got the role And he was unveiled 8th of June 94 at the Regent Palace Hotel at a press conference. And he had a beard, didn't he, like George Lazenby, which was it's quite an interesting, you know. There'd been a few names again, apparently. Mel Gibson again, Hugh Grant, Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson, perhaps, out of those, would have been the most suitable. Yes. Wouldn't
it? I would love to see that alternative universe, to be honest.
Yeah. Very tall, isn't he? But and of course Irish, so that would have been. Apparently he said his then wife Natasha Richardson wouldn't marry him if he accepted the role. So that was But yes, Ralph Fiennes as well. Ralph Fiennes, of course. And it was great to see him come into the franchise as M. I think he would have been terrific. He would have been a great baddie. I mean, we've seen him as a nasty individual in Schindler's List and other films, so he would have been great. Yeah. Very good. Very good. But we know we said it must have been devastating for Pierce. For us fans, it was right that Dalton got it, I think, for Living Daylights. And by the time GoldenEye comes along, Pierce is absolutely perfect for me. And the way he looks in that film, the way he acts, I don't remember anyone at the time saying anything bad about him. No one. Everyone completely accepted him as James Bond and loved it. So when you see a lot of the Brosnan hate these days, when the films were out, there was none of it. He was universally popular. And we've also said before that Tim wasn't really making many public appearances. Well, here, like Sam said, you had adverts with him in. We've seen that one with, what's her name in? It was on Twitter recently. Christina Hendricks, But you had the games. He was just ubiquitous, wasn't he? So he packed so much into those 7 years that it felt like he was Bond for a heck of a lot longer. GoldenEye, guys, yeah. Charlie, can you remember this one? Can you remember Pierce being announced as Bond?
That one I remember. I think it was after, particularly because it was after a 6-year drought.
Yeah.
I was really, really hyped up for the film. I was really, really excited, you know, that there was going to be another Bond movie back in the theaters. And kind of in the same way that the transition from Dr. No to From Russia with Love feels more like a Bond movie to me than Dr. No, mainly because of the musical score where John Barry, it was the first one that had like sort of a unifying feel to the music and the sort of leitmotifs that became associated with characters. And it was the first one that had a really unifying feel. I think the Daniel Kleinman's opening titles for GoldenEye, and I know that the music, the Eric Serra score, is much derided, but I actually really like it. Because it had such a distinctive feel to it. There were so many things about GoldenEye that felt new and different. And I think they all united to make it just a really great, you know, first film for Brosnan. And I think he's to me, he's like the most consistent across his films. I mean, the films themselves, Die Another Day for me being sort of an outlier just because there is so much sort of fantastical stuff, you know, written into the script. But I think Pierce Brosnan's performance is just really spot on throughout his tenure. And I think the way the film was scripted felt like it was written just for him, for his own style, for his way of acting. And, you know, again, like Sam, you mentioned the magic carpet, you know, right in Living Daylights. I mean, thank heavens it didn't get into the film, because I could see Roger doing it, but definitely not Dalton. But I felt that they really tailored the script so beautifully for Pierce Brosnan's style that it just felt right from the very beginning.
So did you know much about him before? Had you seen him in anything?
The only film I saw with him, I hadn't seen Remington Steele. I never watched that show. He was really amazing in The Fourth Protocol, where he played a Russian spy. And also, I know this is maybe kind of a weird tangent, but I found that movie to be really emotionally involving, partly because of Pierce Brosnan's just really sort of flinty performances he was a Soviet spy, if memory serves, in the film. But there's also that scene in the car park where he's trying to find a lookalike to get his passport photo or something like that. But he lures this man out into the car park with like promises of sex. And then there's this kind of, you know, this sort of the start of this intimate scene. And then he just brutally kills the guy. So there was like this sort of, you know, this homoerotic frisson associated with with that film and with, for me, with the actor. And I, weirdly, that kind of sort of set the stage for my appreciation of Pierce Brosnan in the role. Yeah, for what that's worth. I think that was the only thing I'd seen him in prior to his being Bond.
He had those couple of Alistair MacLean films, which were almost like Bond practice films, weren't they? But I think I only saw them after he was, after maybe 95. So there was Night Train and there was Death Wish, and they were always on, like, on BBC One late night, Saturday night after the football. And we always used to watch them. And I mean, they're a bit naff in terms of some of the production values and the music and everything. You could tell this guy is sort of better than this material. This guy is a proper movie star action hero. Again, like I said, no one had any doubt in their minds that this guy is the right man in 94 to be announced as Bond. Sam, you want to watch The Fourth Protocol now, don't you?
I actually did. I do. I've heard of it, but very little. So it's
Michael Caine in it as well.
Michael, yeah.
And I think Joanna Cassidy's in it, and I love her.
Right. Yeah, she's in it. Ned Beatty's in it, who's been in so much stuff. So
yeah, that's her name.
Yeah, so I mean, go watch Fourth Protocol, apparently. But no, I think with GoldenEye, it's another one of those milestone moments where you kind of need to get it right. It can't really be an okay film. It needs to kind of knock it out of the park, because it's kind of getting Bond to the end of the century. Like, can we make it? It feels like, you know, sometimes a break does really good. I think it was good for the series. I mean, bad timing for Dalton's Bond and for that run, of course, but as a whole, to keep the series going, who knows what would have happened had that break not happened, you know, another one of those what ifs. But, you know, I think it needed a refresh, and you can feel it. Everything that you see feels modern. You know, I've said it before, and I put Brosnan's era as kind of like modern Bond. I call like Craig's era like postmodern Bond or whatever. And everything before Brosnan's classic Bond for me. Whereas, you know, Pierce's films just seem to be very much in the middle of both. They kind of straddling both sides, because it feels very much like films that could happen, be made today, just with some updated things in there. But most of what's in there kind of fits to current times, it feels, more so than any other. You know, I feel like Craig's films are probably a bit more dated for me. But Brosnan's, I feel like, despite some tech, stand the strength of time. But GoldenEye's fantastic on every single level for me. I think Brosnan's perfect in it. You know, I think we've said before about the first films for these actors, and all of them are good. No one has a bad performance. No one lets down a film, or the film is never so bad it's like, oh, well, that was a shaky start. And I think he was probably ready, having all of those years, to kind of think, oh, this isn't happening, suddenly having it happen. You've got to kind of go into that with a positive attitude of, if this happens, I can do anything. You would never know where this can go. Clearly, it goes by jumping off a dam at the beginning, which is one of the most iconic shots in Bond. Maybe, you know, sticking your head down from a toilet bathroom ceiling is also iconic for different reasons, but I love it. And it's like, okay, it gives you a sense of who his Bond is immediately, with a quip as his first line, and knocking some guy out who's reading a newspaper. But no, yeah, Tom, when we said about what it does, about the advertisement, the kind of the rush of things coming out about Bond, whether it's, you know, things to do for kids or more things for adults or just anything to kind of showcase Bond, I feel like it's because of this film and this film's success. You wouldn't have had all that opportunity otherwise. And when it opens it up to a brand new audience, and yeah, I agree with Charlie. Eric Serra's score for me is quite good, underrated. I think I understand why people don't like it, but I think it makes this film unique. The other thing I say about GoldenEye in particular, rather than just his whole four films, is that GoldenEye feels like it could have just been taken, lifted out, and it could have just been in its own film and it would have been fine. The look of it looks different than Tomorrow Never Dies and The World Is Not Enough, which to me seem very similar. I don't know whether it's the way Martin Campbell is, you know, having this film shot or anything, but just the look of that mixed with how Brosnan looks, with how MI6 is, with what, you know, see what locations are used, with the score, everything to me kind of matches up to kind of feel this could have been its own film. Kind of like how people say like Casino Royale could have just have been a standalone.
Yeah.
And it just feels very much, I say it's timeless, but it also feels very much of its time, which you know, it absolutely doesn't make sense. But to me, it's true. You know, you go, okay, that's a film from 1995, but then you go, that's one of the best films ever, and it's understandable why people hold GoldenEye in such high regard, and that for many, it's kind of the more modern day Goldfinger, because it does do everything you would want out of a Bond film, and especially for general audiences, which to the producers is the most important thing, is to cater to their needs more than the hardcore fans like us, because they're more few than large compared to the masses. Just amazing, amazing film.
I would think I was 12, 13 when it came out. We were obsessed with Bond, and I was in the same class as Rob. When we were able to watch it at the cinema, because we just turned 12, it was absolutely perfect. And, you know, we couldn't have been more obsessed with Bond. But up until then, it was probably only us in the class who were real Bond fans. But when that came out, because everybody else was 12, they all sort of fell in love with Bond at the same time. And it was such a popular film in our school year. And then the next year or the year after, we had the game. And it's just like a double header of greatness for James Bond. And I think, Sam, the first Bond film you saw at the cinema was Dying of the Day. When did you actually, or was it?
Casino. No, it was Casino. Yeah. So I didn't see any.
Which was the first Brosnan you saw then?
It was Golden. It probably was Golden. I saw bits of GoldenEye on the TV. I feel like it might have been the premiere of it on ITV, maybe. Like I was really young, but I remember seeing. I remember the pre-title sequence up until the Xenia Admiral scene in bed, where that was when it was a family party and it was on. And then when that scene came on, I was like, no, and walked out. I must have only been about maybe like 4 or something. Like I was really young, and everything up until that point, I was like, oh, great. And when you're really little and you see a Ferrari, and I had, you know, toy Ferrari cars, you see that with an Aston Martin, which I'd seen from the film Goldfinger, because I had that on video. There was some weird connections there. And it was, so I was really into it, but then I didn't see the whole thing for I think about at least 4-5 years later. And then after that, I probably did see bits of Tomorrow Never Dies and The World Is Not Enough on TV. And I'd seen bits of Dying of a Day, but I never saw like a full Brosnan film. It again was more the games at that point that I was playing more than seeing his films. But it never felt like, oh, this is, I can't watch these. It was just, I think, again, because the games were there and I had the videos of the Bonds that I had. And that was fine for me at the time. But I think as soon as you kind of dive deeper a little bit, and I think that was once Revenge of the Sith had come out and Star Wars was kind of done, because that was my obsession. That was the number one obsession. So I had a gap in my calendar, in my schedule as a 10-year-old. It's like, well, what can I turn to now? And it's like, oh, great. There's 20 films, 4 of which I've seen and partially seen others. Let's just do that. So, but Brosnan was Bond. That was the case. And when 2004, 2005, to me, he was still Bond up until it was said, oh yeah, Craig's Bond. And it's like, okay, that's random. I just got Everything or Nothing months before.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he definitely hard done by, and it's not a fair, I don't think it's very fair, but at the same time, as with the break between License to Kill and GoldenEye, sometimes things need to change. And things have to happen for something to survive. So I can understand their point of view. But I think when someone truly appreciates a role and a character, you kind of don't like it when they get screwed over.
The more you hear about it, that he suggested a much more gritty Bond, the next film. I think he did mention he'd like to tackle Casino Royale. And obviously the rights were forever connected to that. I don't know whether they would have been ready by 2004. It was all sort of just going away from him, and we'll get onto that, you know, when Daniel is cast. But Charlie, in terms of the performance from Pierce, it's a pretty assured one, isn't it? He doesn't look nervous. He gets stuck into the action. He's extremely likable. He does the quips, and he's great with the ladies. So it's a pretty much perfect performance for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about sort of what they show. You know, Roger Moore's debut was pretty quiet, that he's just waking up and, you know, waking up in bed. But both with Dalton and Brosnan, mainly in the pre-title sequence, and then you know, scenes earlier in the film, you see Brosnan and, you know, this amazing stunt, which is the very first thing. You see this amazing action sequence at several, you know, the chemical weapons facility place. You know, then you have this wonderful casino scene, which is very Bondian. And so it's like both with Dalton and Brosnan, I think they were they're piling on all of these iconic Bond sort of situations, as if to say, and because I was thinking about it with respect to Lazenby's intro, and for both Dalton and Brosnan, it's like, this always happens to this fella.
Yeah,
that's what they were trying to say in the first like 10 minutes of each of those films, just laying it on thick, you know. And Sam, something you said about this, that it would work as a standalone film, I totally agree with. But during this last watch, I was struck by how many elements in the script harken back to earlier in Bond's career, you know, because he's being evaluated by the woman who's, you know, sent out to you know, evaluate his performance in the field. And you know, there's the fact that the whole pre-title sequence is a flashback to a yeah. theoretical earlier part of his career. Then there's the quote from Trevelyan. He says, you know, that I can't remember the exact words, but he refers back to all the men that you've killed and all the women that you failed to protect. And so I think there was a strong desire on the part of the script writers to relate his character to from earlier in his career, but without specific references. I mean, I think a reference to Tracy would no longer have worked just because of the amount of time that had elapsed, you know, since 1969. I'm not a fan of timelines per se, but I can understand how they wouldn't have done that. But yeah, he's so assured in the role. And I said earlier that I think Dalton is really maybe the best at pulling together all of the different elements of the character. But if it's not a tie, I mean, Brosnan is a close second because he does all of that so well. All of the, you know, the action, his look, the relationships that he has with the other characters. He does all of it so well and did all of it so well through all four of his films.
And he's another one who really is loved in the Bond community, especially by my age and below. Definitely the Bond that they grew up with. We never saw Tim in the cinema or Roger. I think it was a momentous thing to have a James Bond when you're growing up and you could watch the films. Daniel's films were a bit more adult, maybe, you know, the first, I know they weren't 15s, but they were getting there. Well, License to Kill, that was another reason we
yeah. That.
But yeah, he's a very accessible Bond, isn't he? And your friends loved him and everyone didn't have a bad word to say about him.
Yeah, and I think some people forget about how much kind of like good one-to-one, you know, dialogue scenes he has. I mean, yeah. I'm just thinking out of the top of my head. I mean, he has that conversation with Alec. He has his first real big conversation with Judi Dench's M, which, you know, everyone loves and remembers. Yeah, I mean, his banter with Moneypenny, which is one of my favorite scenes from the film.
Yeah,
that's a great scene.
Good evening, Moneypenny.
Good evening, James. M will meet you in the Situation Room. I'm to take you straight in.
I've never seen you after hours, Moneypenny. Lovely.
Thank you, James.
Out on some kind of professional assignment? Dressing a kill?
You know, you'll find this crushing, 007. When I don't sit at home every night praying for some international incident so I can run down here all dressed up to impress James Bond. I was on a date, if you must know, with a gentleman. We went to the theatre together.
Oh, Moneypenny, I'm devastated. What would I ever do without you?
As far as I can remember, James, you've never had me.
Hope springs eternal.
You know, this sort of behavior could qualify as sexual harassment.
Really? What's the penalty for that?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Someday you have to make good on your innuendos.
The casino with Xenia, you know, with at least with almost every single one, Natalia, of course, as well. With everyone of these characters, he gets to have some real good interaction. I think that makes the character of Bond a bit more whole, because it feels like he's kind of like, you're kind of ticking everyone off in a good or bad way, whatever. But it works, and it there's a lot of that, which then balances out the humor and the action that's going on, which there's also quite a lot of, maybe not super excessive with the humor, but he does it in such a smooth way. I think with Brosnan, I think one of his main things is his charm. He's got it, and he uses it, whether it's with a woman, whether it's talking back to someone. He doesn't lose his cool all the time, but when he does, I feel like that's when I see more Dalton than anyone else, because I feel like Connery and Moore very seldom lost their calm. Whereas, you know, we just said about Dalton in Living Daylights, when he's angry, he's angry. And I feel like you get that with Brosnan, and maybe he doesn't unleash fully, but you see glimpses of that.
Pre-tight sequence when he thinks that 006 is shot.
Mm. His face. Yeah.
It's really effective, that, without any lines like, oh no, or, you know, it's not on the nose, is it? It's a really good piece of acting.
And it's like that throughout the rest of his run as well. I mean, you know, I think of, you know, when he finds Paris in Tomorrow Never Dies, and then how he is with Dr. Kaufman. He's not letting this guy go at all. Yeah, I think he is underrated in his acting ability. I think people just think of Brosnan's pain face and a couple of weirdly inflected lines, which, yes, are weird. And no one's denying that. No one denies that he's got some weird pain face from time to time. But for me, it doesn't take over an entire thing. No one's run should be took over by one wrong thing. And wrong is not the right word, but for some people, that is what they would say. But it's a questionable choice, one that some people love, some that people don't. Absolutely fair. All opinions are fair on it, of course. But no, I think his performance in GoldenEye is fantastic. And I can't say it could be his best performance, but I think there's things in Someone Never Dies in the World, isn't enough that really level up as well. I think, like Charles said, his performance is consistent. I think Dying of a Day is a little bit iffy there, but I do feel like that's more scripts than anything else. Whereas I think the three films are very consistent for me, and they're all very enjoyable. And for me, it's a shame that he went out on Dying of a Day. And I know there's a lot of Dying of a Day out defenders out there, and I love you all, but
you're not one of them.
I think it's awful, but I enjoy it. I
watched it at the cinema last year, Sam, so I know your feeling.
But I mean, it's enjoyable. That's the thing. It's not Quantum. So I mean, I'll give it that.
I find Die Another Day really, really enjoyable. And actually it's gone up in my estimation. And I think one of the things that when I think about Pierce Brosnan, well, his delivery of the word, the line mojito, or however he says it, that's a bit weird, but the fact that so much of the dialogue and the banter was so over the top, you know, like this sort of salacious quips that he has, you know, but the thing about it is that he's totally believable in it. They don't come across to me as like you know, missteps or anything. I mean, he's just really invested in the role, and he delivers all those lines, and he does it better than anybody else could, and he makes those really dodgy lines work really well in the context of the film.
He's got a lot to work with, doesn't he? You know, these are very different. I know Dalton's got very personal, but these are all quite personal stories to him, you know, especially World Is Not Enough, the Electra relationship, and then M, of course, being captured. And even, you know, the pre-title sequence, and is it just after that, isn't it, when he's captured in Dying of the Day? We haven't seen this before. It's getting a little bit more, the torture will continue, obviously, in Casino Royale, but he does have a lot of acting, in inverted commas, to do, and it does start in GoldenEye with the personal connection to Trevelyan.
Yeah, no, it is great. And I think people sometimes just forget about those particular parts of the stories, because it's Alec, it's Paris, it's Electra and M, and then it's Dying of the Day is his life, his, you know, however long, I can't remember, that he was in prison for, who betrayed him, which feels like that should have been more of the main thing of Dying of the Day rather than what happened. I think that's a more interesting story about who, like, rather than it feels kind of like, oh, that's it was revealed to be Miranda and then that's it. And I feel like that's more of, you've been imprisoned in a North Korean jailed for 2 years, however long it is. Like, and then it's like, okay, Miranda did it, and then it's like, okay, let's stop Icarus. Come on.
Well, and just, and also that you know, if his Miranda's betrayal of him, if that's the emotional part of the film, he's not the one who eventually confronts her. You know, he's fighting RoboCop while Jinx is, you know. So in a way, that was kind of a disconnect for me as well, because it just seemed it seemed like it wasn't following through, Sam, as you say, on that theme of betrayal. So it just seemed kind of a cheat by the end of the film. But Sam, what you said about like that there's these characters with whom he has this really strong, you know, emotional relationship in each of the films, you know, Alec, Harris, Elektra. Yeah, that really rings true. And they're very different. They're very different kinds of emotional stories throughout, which I thought was really, which provided a nice variety among his films, as opposed to just simply going rogue in every film.
Yeah. And I think that's why I would call it like the modern Bond, because it's doing different things, but it's not straying so far from the formula that it becomes unrecognizable. It does it in a very, it for me still feels modern, and it's just the mid to late 90s. And I think that's why for me those films are standing the test of time a bit stronger than some of the others. Even though I watch them all, I love them all, even if I don't particularly like them that much. So Bros love is real too, not just Bros hate.
Yes. What a lovely thing to say, Sam, about Pierce, yeah. And it was sad to see him go, and I remember it happening. And he is still the only Bond, really, who wanted to stay and who was forced out. I remember, if you see the 40th anniversary BAFTA sort of celebration, which was in 2002, and of course, Dying of the Day, it was sort of a tie-in with that. It was like, yeah, I'm signed up. I think he said, I'm signed up for two more, so I can't wait to get going. And you do feel sorry for him, and particularly as I think they offered it to him, but then MGM told Barbara and Michael to sort of, can you actually go back to him and say no? And they had to have this painful conversation. And he's very honest about it, isn't he? He's very game, and he obviously probably didn't speak to them for a while, but he's not sort of fallen out with them. And he's still, you know, he's still happy to be part of the Bond franchise. He's still very proud of it. I mean, I've not said this before, but often in sport, if a manager is sacked, they've always, coincidentally, they've got a replacement ready straight away. Mm. And you think, oh, right, you've tried to get this person before, you've sat the other one, and you were just trying to find the right time. With Bond, they've never done that, have they? They've always, and with Daniel Craig, they didn't do it. It's not like, oh, we've got this guy in mind, we don't want you. They were like, no, we want to go in a different direction. We'll need a bit of a breather to work out what we're doing, and then we'll cast the next Bond based on that, which is the right way to do it, and is what we're led to believe they're doing now, as we speak, with the seventh Bond.
Hi, I'm Star Parodi.
And I'm Jeff Fair.
And we're the creators of the music for the Bond GoldenEye teaser trailer, the Parodi Fair version. And you are listening to the amazing...
Really 007.
So yeah, apparently though, over 200 names were in the frame for the Bond in Casino Royale. One of them was Goran Vesnik, who was in ER, who is actually in the new Hellraiser film, which I saw recently. But apparently it was the accents that did for him. He's Croatian. But he looks the part. He still looks the part. He would have been a good Bond, I think. Carl Urban had a screen test, but he couldn't make it due to film commitments. I can't see that myself. Sam Worthington, who I've just loved again in Avatar. Go and watch it, everybody. Some other names, I mean, like Ewan McGregor, I can't see it. I love him dearly, of course, for Star Wars and all that. But and Julian McMahon, everyone remember him?
Yes, he was Charmed? It was the Australian.
He was the baddie in Fantastic Four. The good ones with Ewan Griffin.
Was it Nip Tuck or
that's something? It, Nip Tuck, yeah. And he's Australian, but he may have been a bit small, but he looked very sort of dashing and he looked quite Bond. But anyway, and Rupert Friend, again, someone who's never quite, who's always been in the frame, you know, I would say would be a decent fit. Rufus Sewell as well is another one who I'd have loved to see as Bond.
Rufus Sewell's great. Cold Rufus, Comfort Farm.
Yeah. I don't know whether I think it must have been at this time that he was considered, but I remember seeing an article in the Times, you know, they had odds for each actor. And that's when Colin Salmon was actually, you know, he was, but it would have been weird if, you know, he just played another role and then immediately he's Bond in the next one, as much as I love him. it would have been a bit jarring perhaps. But yeah, Rufus Sewell is, oh, absolutely love the guy. Dougray Scott, who was the baddie in Mission Impossible 2. And of course, they were trying to get John Woo for Dying of the Day. So it was all, that MTV editing era of cinema. But they wanted to do something completely different, didn't they, for Casino Royale. Eventually, they chose Daniel Craig. It would be a bit silly to say he was unknown. He'd been in some really important television programs and some very well-respected films at the time. But he wasn't like a name. He wasn't sort of, you know, we're talking about the next Bond now and you see Henry Cavill or someone like that. He's a name already, isn't he? Trying to think of somebody now who isn't. It's difficult now because everyone gets so bigged up for years because we've got this gap that they become a name even though perhaps they haven't done an awful lot. Like Regis Jean-Page, you know, he's, give him chance, he's only been in two or three things, but he's been talked about so much that he is now, oh no, he's too famous. You know, he's too famous.
I think there's also like there's a definitely regional / international thing as well, because there's certain names that we in the UK would say, but then someone from America, Charlie, wouldn't know them. Potentially, because they've only been in British dramas or something. So for us, it might say, "Oh, well, they're not unknown." But on a wider global scale, they are unknown. They've not been leads in massive, you know, Hollywood productions or anything like that. You know, I think my kind of like modern day equivalent would be kind of like closer to Roger Moore, maybe, but like an Aidan Turner who has done lots of things. Is a good actor, but hasn't gone to that next level. And for me, could potentially be one of those to get there.
Normally, in a big franchise, you might think, right, we've got a lot riding on this. We can't risk an unknown actor. But with Bond, you've got the luxury of the franchise is massive. People will go and watch it, whatever. So we can spend more time getting the right person rather than who's making a lot of money at the moment. Let's get them in the title role, even if they're not right for it. So yeah, Daniel Craig was chosen. With it, I think he did it originally a bit like some of the others, that he was a bit sceptical at the start because he wasn't keen on where the series was going. The producers weren't either. And so when he read the scripts and he read all the Fleming novels, a bit like Dalton, that's when he thought, right, I've got somewhere now. I've got a new angle to go for this that will be his take. And he'd actually just been in Munich, the film, the Steven Spielberg film, where he was a Mossad agent. So I think he'd spoken to British secret agents in preparation for the role, and he was sort of in that frame of mind where, yes, I've got a bit of experience now and I can be up for this.
Yes?
For you.
Something you expect me to wear?
I need you looking fabulous, so that when you walk up behind me and kiss me on the neck, the players across from me will be thinking about your neckline and not about their cards. Do you think you can do that for me?
I'll do my best.
Thank you. I have a dinner jacket.
There are dinner jackets and dinner jackets. This is the latter, and I need you looking like a man who belongs at that table.
It's tailored.
I sized you up the moment we met.
Our sort of thoughts on Daniel Craig are a bit famous, but to be fair to Craig, he's the only Bond actor who's had real stick from the start. From when he was cast, he's had it like no one else has had. The Craig Not Bond website, when he went on to that, you know, the first press conference and people have a go at him for wearing a life jacket. I've never seen him look more Bond than in that. He looked class with the sunglasses and everything, and his hair was a bit... And he was a bit prickly in the interview, but so was Tim, to be fair, when he was unveiled in Vienna. It got off to a bad start. So he had, I don't know, the producers were probably a little bit worried, weren't they, until the film came out.
Yeah, it's difficult because especially with like an initial press conference, because nothing's been done yet. They've not got a film in the can or anything. Like, it's literally just, oh, I've seen the script. Obviously, I can't give anything away. I don't really know how it's going to go down, so I can't really tell you anything. And you say that, you see that in a lot of these kind of pre-film things that they've done. Like, I remember like that weird interview panel thing before No Time to Die even started properly shooting, and it just is awkward because there's nothing to say. So in my mind, it's like, well, what's the point in doing it? It's not like when an artist has announced a tour and they're going to answer questions. It's a different type of thing, but a new era of a franchise, I think it's difficult to do that. You would prefer kind of like a one-to-one interview or on like a chat show, you know, where you can kind of talk a bit more about yourself and your past and where you've come from and what you're coming to. So I can absolutely understand, you know, his perspective at that moment. But then all the initial feedback was terrible. And it's the first time you kind of get, you know, I think when Brosnan was announced, it was the infancy of what the internet was. So only people who could get onto it were using it. And even then, I'm not sure that all of them were going to be talking about James Bond. Whereas this was the point where, you know, dial-up was starting to go and Wi-Fi was starting to be used, and that was coming on more. So news was being transferred easier. But I remember seeing it was still a time where I was seeing all the newspapers, you know, Helga Brandt. It was in all the newspapers, you know, James Bland and James Blonde. And you know, it, like, they based everything off that one introduction, and he's not even playing Bond. He's just an actor doing a job. And just... Yeah, exactly. So it's just, it was unfair. At the time, I was unsure, but it was the first time I was seeing something like this happen, and he didn't look like Bond. And as a 10-year-old when he got announced, it's kind of like, oh, this is different and I'm not sure about this at all. But then you do need to give someone the time. You can't say anything without any context or with any information.
I agree. And I'd be more negative, but It was his look, I think, that sort of put me off. And he was a bit smaller. No one really ever mentions that. It's true. But if you're going back to the Fleming, then he's too small, isn't he? But anyway, the thing people often say is that he got judged on before they'd seen him. And then when they seen him, they really liked it. But he was judged on his looks. The performance is what put me off. No. The style they went down is my complaint, not the way he looks particularly. But of course, the general audience and Bond fans, it was the performance that, well, if they weren't won over, the film was a massive success and his performance in it got a BAFTA nomination. I mean, that's unheard of for any other Bond films, getting any actor nominated, never mind Bond himself. So even though it was awful for him at the time, it really gave them a sort of, we're going to show them here. And they knew, didn't they, when they started filming, I think they knew this is going to be a cracker. And with Martin Campbell coming back, do you think Martin Campbell was a big part of the success of Casino Royale?
No, I do. Absolutely. Yeah, I do. I think Martin Campbell, and I think also the fact that they were using like actual Fleming material for the first time in, you know, I don't know how many decades, right? Since it would have really been since 1969, probably, that...
Since that, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
that a good part of the film was actually based on the story, as opposed to just being random, you know, character names lifted from it, or, you know, the isolated situation. But no, I think Martin Campbell was a really big part of why I liked the film so much. And it's definitely one of the ones that I rarely watch it, but I think it's one of the very best films.
It's not a Sunday afternoon Bond film, is it?
No. No, I'm more likely to put in Man with a Golden Gun than I am.
Oh, I am.
Much more likely than Casino Royale. I mean, I think it's a really wonderful film. I think it also, to what you said, Sam, and you may have mentioned this already, but that it's one of the ones that can exist as a standalone.
Yes,
where you don't have to link it to all the other ones and think of it as being part of the Bond universe, you know, to enjoy it as just a really great story.
I mean, that might be part of the problem, wasn't it, that because it was so successful, they thought, right, let's continue immediately after. When they filmed Casino Royale, I don't think they were intending to sort of continue. Every film would be Bond struggling and Bond sort of developing like this. You know, I think obviously Sam Mendes was like, right, no, we're getting Moneypenny, we're getting Q back now. We need to go to a bit more classic Bond. Who knows whether that was the intention for Casino Royale? It certainly wasn't the intention for Quantum of Solace. And this definitely is a standalone Bond for me. You don't need to see any of the others, and you can even see No Time to Die pretty much after this, and it would sort of make sense. But yeah, Sam, what you said, it was obviously a bit odd to see this chap as Bond. And what did you think when you saw it at the cinema then?
Yes, I mean, I kind of envy your childhood a little bit here, Tom, because I mean, you say your first Bond in cinema was GoldenEye, and mine was Casino Royale, and that sounds so shady and so terrible. Like, I hated Casino Royale. I didn't, but again, I was 11 at that point, and I had a certain expectation of what James Bond was, and this wasn't it. So I wasn't displeased, but I wasn't jumping for joy, going, "Oh my God, wasn't that like the best?" As a film, I appreciated it even from that age, appreciated what it was doing, but it was difficult. It was difficult to kind of latch onto it, and I think because everything had been so pushed with merch before that, and then suddenly that was all gone, and there was nothing. So there was no other way as a kid to kind of re-enter the franchise again on a personal level. You know, it was a transitionary kind of time for me anyway. You know, you go from primary school to high school. There's new people in your life. You know, outside of that, you know, I was beginning to figure out, you know, my sexuality and stuff. So for me, there was a lot of stuff going on, and then it just felt, oh, Bond's changed as well. And it's like, okay, here's another thing that's kind of like, that's not the same, and I'm enjoying less, which kind of felt like everything at that point. So for something that I kind of needed to escape to, it wasn't it. However, I enjoyed it and liked it enough that it wasn't like, oh, no, I'm stepping away from that. If maybe I was a year younger or two, I could have maybe been like, oh, that's absolutely not. Yeah, I probably wouldn't have even been able to go to the cinema. I'm not sure. Was it a PG or was it a 12A?
I think it was a 12A.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, but I still talked about it endlessly anyway. And I think it would be different if it was a bad film, but it's absolutely one of the best made. And if it's not in my top 10, I don't watch it very regularly, but for me, it's the best Daniel Craig film. It's one of his strongest performances. I think everything's so tight. Martin Campbell knows what he's doing, and having this kind of refresh attitude that I think everyone must have had to kind of say, let's make a good film. Everyone, despite the numbers that Dying of the Day had, reviews were not kind, and a lot of people were like, well, what do you do? And it's, you know, it's very much the Moonraker for Your Eyes Only thing. Well, it's like, well, let's just go back to realism. But it was taking that to the next level, and it was a new sort of filmmaking. It felt of the time. And you know, I've said in other places about this post 9/11 filmmaking and what they were trying to do with stories. You couldn't be so bombastic as the previous Bonds had been, and especially not as how Dying of Day had been. And everything was more gritty. All films at that time were going, well, this is the darker side of Bond, and this is the darker side of Batman. I wasn't ready for that change in general in film. I liked my lighter films. I still do. Batman and Robin, The Phantom Menace, Calamity Jane, whatever you want. You know, that was kind of what I enjoyed. So it was weird to go in this direction as an adult. Newfound appreciation, and I'm very glad that, you know, that was my first one that I'd seen in the cinema, and I have a lot of good memories. But no one can look at Casino Royale and go, oh, that's bad, and oh, that's bad, and that was poor. Like, as a film, it's done impeccably well.
Charlie, did you go into it expecting something quite different to Dying of the Day? I mean, you must have done a bit.
Yeah, I did. I had seen Daniel Craig in one other film, Road to Perdition, which I think...
Oh, yeah, good film.
Is that a Sam Mendes film?
Sam Mendes, yeah. I think that's what... That relationship, I think it was Daniel who suggested Sam Mendes, because obviously he knew him from that, for Skyfall, yeah.
Right, and so I just, you know, because it's a somber film. I mean, a serious film, and I guess that's... I think that was the only thing I'd seen him in prior to Casino Royale, but both from the fact that, I mean, for me, the assumption was that they were going to, now that they finally had the rights to film the novel, that they would be, you know, that they wouldn't squander it by just doing some wacky film using only the title, that they would actually, you know, do a serious treatment of the story, which is a very serious story. So I was expecting it to be, you know, a grittier, more serious more serious film. And just also from the sort of the history of the same as you say, like, you know, going Fear Eyes Only, following on from, you know, Moonraker. I mean, that is sort of an ebb and flow to these things. And just thinking, well, Die Another Day was really sort of that decade's Moonraker. And yeah, thinking that they're probably going to do a reset.
The plot's very similar as well. Yeah, very Fleming.
But yeah, that's right.
In terms of Daniel Craig's performance, what do you make of it, Charlie?
Oh, I thought it was great. I thought it was really good. And I know that it was the first one, was particularly with the benefit of hindsight, where they were trying to really show a growth in the character, like a change in the character. I mean, that he's starting out getting his 00 and then, you know, showing an evolving relationship with his superiors and with the institution that he works for. And I thought that was pretty daring. And I thought that they generally did a good job with it within the context of that film. I actually really like Quantum of Solace. It's one of my favorites. And as being sort of the first, well, it really is the first direct sequel to any of the films. And I thought that they continued to show an evolution in his character effectively across those two films. So I thought his performance was very, very good.
Because it is very different. You know, a lot of it is about his character. GoldenEye, we mentioned, there's umpteen unbelievable side characters. And you'd think if you have a new Bond now, it's all about Bond, isn't it? It's not about anybody else, really. With Casino Royale, it's a proper character study, isn't it? Of, like you say, there's so much mention of the ego, what a blunt instrument and all this. The relationship with Vesper particularly does change the character, doesn't it? And you see that growth. And I think it's quite a Bond thing to do where a villain will be introduced halfway through. A bit like, well, Silver is, isn't he, in Skyfall? Donald Pleasance in You Only Live Twice. You know, it's happened quite a lot through the Bond films. But here, the Bond girl, it's like a different film, isn't it, beforehand? When I was watching it at the cinema, I was like, oh, this is still very Bond. The first half, it felt very Bond. The love thing, and then the main villain just getting killed by someone else. Those are the bits like, oh, wow, this is too different. I can't compute this right now. Even though I know it's in the book and everything. The more I see them, the more I admire them. And I do think watching this again at the cinema in the UK in 2022, that was another formative thing, and watching it with my wife, who really loved it. When you watch it with someone who's loving it, it makes you appreciate it more, I think, as well. If you just treat it as a one-off, it is flawless in what it's trying to execute, and that's the main thing here. And Craig, I do think it's by far his best performance. He's not necessarily the most likable in this one. That's because he's a bit younger and more reckless and everything. It sets it up nicely, doesn't it? It sets it up very nicely for the next Bond. Even though I didn't like it at the time, Quantum, I absolutely love it now. So all the Bonds, they all have something brilliant about them, even if you don't like them. There's all so much good stuff in them. And Casino Royale, it regularly comes out as the top, doesn't it, in people's rankings. Mm-hmm. They're very, very top. It must have been a great Bond debut.
Yeah, and I think another thing about it, which I tend not to kind of go to, but it's how brutal the film is. And I think Craig's run is brutal anyway, but I think especially with Casino Royale, I mean, there's so much death and so much violence, more so it feels than any other, and everything hits harder. Everything, you kind of feel everything a bit more. And I think the aim is to just showcase, highlight how awful of a life it is. No matter, we've grown to kind of, you know, maybe not want it exactly, but you kind of want to kind of live in Bond's world a little bit, but it's not a nice world to live in. You know, that staircase fight is just so much, and you see from Vesper's reaction just how effective that could be for someone who's not trained for that, who's not, yep, you know, into that stuff. The whole, you know, sequence in Madagascar, that chase sequence is one of the best chases of the series. Bond's getting into that, he's jumping from cranes, and just every time he hits the crane and he lands, and I feel like his ribs are about to like crack and explode or something with how hard it hits. And just seeing so much blood on Bond, which you don't see very often either. I appreciate what they were trying to do to kind of bring this back, even though it's not my preferred type of Bond film. You got to appreciate what they were going to do, and they did it successfully. And I think that's the main thing. It would have been different if they wanted to do this and it wasn't successful and it wasn't good. And I kind of wish Craig's era was more consistent with this, because had there been more films on this level, then I think a lot of people would appreciate it more. But at the same time, a lot of general audiences absolutely love these films, you know, to death, and they've been here for, well, they've been there for 15 years up until No Time to Die to watch it. And you can see by the numbers that No Time to Die got in despite the pandemic, that people wanted to see another Bond film. Craig is conflicting to me, but I mean, he helped keep the franchise going, and that's the main thing, and get it ready for the next person to take on.
You're absolutely right. And it, you know, it was the 40-year anniversary for Dying of the Day. 20 years later, it's in as good a position in terms of finances and interest in it. I think you could say it hasn't brought in as many younger fans, the Craig era, but it's brought in loads more of the older fans who maybe have come back to it. My mum and dad started coming back to see Skyfall, and, you know, all the films since then they've been really interested in watching. The box office is weird because it's like, it's maybe not done quite as well in America and across the world, the Craigs, but these are like, I think all of them are in the top 50 biggest films ever in Britain. And I think Skyfall and Spectre and No Time to Die are like the top three of the top five or something ridiculous, you know, ever in Britain. And it's, you know, you can try and get that some now at the start.
I will, because I saw it a few months ago, and so I know you. Yeah. I know you're right.
I think, was it The Force Awakens? Was that the only one that was top? I can't remember now.
Yes. So Force Awakens is number one, Skyfall's number two, and No Time to Die is number three, with Spectre being five. And then the next one is Casino Royale at 22, but still, you know, in that top 50.
That's incredible, isn't it, really, to think? It was a massive event when No Time to Die came out in England particularly, because it was the first film that anyone really had seen post-pandemic. It was absolutely packed, I remember. But all of them were. You know, Casino Royale, when it came out, there was a sort of general, from the wider audience, a little bit of interest pricked up, because it was like, oh, it's a bit different. This might be a bit more like the Connerys. I don't know. It might be a bit more like the ones I remember. And you get the Aston Martin coming more and more, and you get the sort of Bond drinking and just not being a sort of action hero who doesn't do anything wrong, a vulnerable person. And it was all, that was filmmaking taste, wasn't it, in the 2000s? And it was the gritty fighting styles of Bourne, and it struck a chord with audiences. And I think we've done well, you know, and we still have a franchise because of that. Okay, we would have liked some more films in between, wouldn't we? Because he's done five. He could have done about seven or eight, couldn't he?
He could have done more.
But
I mean, it's like I'm going to say, like, we were lucky enough to have all the films at the cinemas last year.
Yeah.
And by far, the Craig films had the most attendance. You know, the other screenings sometimes only had 10 people in, something insane like that. And most if not all of the Craig screenings had almost fully booked, which did surprise me and didn't surprise me at the same time, because, you know, a lot of them are so recent compared to the others. Yeah. But it just shows how much of an impact Casino Royale and the rest of those films made.
Tom, you said about wishing that we had more Craig films, you know, in the era, because he was, you know, he was Bond for a very long time, but not for that many films, because they were produced, you know, at such wide intervals. But one of my wishes for the Craig era is that we had more standalone adventures, you know, more standalone stories that weren't necessarily connected to other stories. I was thinking a line from, I think it's from Hildebrandt Rarity, that Milton Crest says it. He's talking about, I think he's talking about the U.S., but I think it could apply to... No, of course he wouldn't be, because he was very chauvinistically American. But I think maybe he was... I can't remember what he was talking about. He was talking about a country progressing from infancy to senility without going through maturity. And in a way, I kind of feel that about Craig's tenure, and that it's like we're shown an origin story in the first film, but then as soon as the third film, it's already old dog, new tricks, you know, and that we're seeing him at the beginning and the end of his career, but not really experiencing much in the middle.
Nearly 10 years between the one where he's meant to be old and past it and his last film. He's 10 years older in that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
But again, each one, it's not the fault of the other, isn't it? It's because they were sort of doing it as they went along and testing the waters. Because I think 2010 standalone Bond film, would have all have loved that, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, it's the timing of when the rights to the intellectual property occurred. Because, you know, with Spectre, You know, I think they were sort of setting Quantum up as being Spectre. I mean, it was a Spectre type organization. You know, this cabal of secret, people who had these nefarious plots and everything. And then suddenly, hey presto, they get the rights to do Spectre. They get the rights to use Blofeld and those characters. And so I think they, in my opinion, they kind of sort of clumsily sort of retconned the events of the prior films to sort of fit this new thing that they were suddenly able to do. And so I think the timing of that was rather unfortunate in the way that it shaped the arc of those films.
So going on to the future then, for the next James Bond debut, it's all over the internet every day, isn't it? There's always these clickbait articles. Oh, so-and-so's been cast, definitely. They've been seen at Pinewood and all this. And at the moment, I'm just at the stage where I'm not going to believe anything until we get an official announcement because it's just pointless. Someone was looking back and they were trying to see from, I think, when Daniel Craig was cast, could they find anything weeks and months before? And there were a couple of newspaper little articles saying they'd been rumoured to have met with people. But it was never massively in the press until it was officially announced. It's far more difficult, though, now, isn't it? Because I remember seeing pictures of No Time to Die, a little girl, and we were like, oh, well, of course that isn't Bond's kid. And then you find out he does have a kid. It turned out it was Matilde as a girl, so it wasn't really that. And then, rumours he died, and oh no, of course not. It's so much harder to stop things from leaking now. It's really difficult. In fact, the best thing that didn't leak was the fans didn't spoil it. You know, that was amazing that for so long it wasn't. Was there a few weeks before it was out in America, wasn't there? And was that
It was. There was. Yeah.
Did you not? You didn't have it ruined, did you, Charlie?
Not by anybody outside of the film itself. No.
So how did you find out before you saw the film that he died?
No.
Oh, good. All right. Okay. Well, that's good. Right. Oh, dear me. David famously did, didn't he? Dear me.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Was it an aunt of his?
Because he waited. He did wait to see it because of his tradition of watching it with his whole family, looking at a screen. So he had to endure all of us watching it and obviously not us not saying anything directly to him, but I think a lot of people were being respectful. On social media to try not to say anything because some people weren't going into the cinema straight away. And I think people wanted to know what maybe initial reactions were to the film more so than the plot details themselves. So no, it makes me happy to know that anyway, that the people can disagree, but I mean, the experience of watching a film for the first time, you're never going to get that back again. So you want to go in that right mindset. If you know one thing and you're just waiting for that to happen, and you can't experience everything else that you could love about the film.
Do you think that has any bearing, Charlie, on the next Bond person? The fact that he's dead? Or do you think, just forget it, just start again, pretend it didn't happen?
I hope that's what they... that they do. I mean, you know, I can't imagine what else they might do. I think that for me, the argument is that they were obviously going for this multi-film Craig story arc and that it can be seen to be sort of outside of the other, you know, the other, timelines in the series, although there aren't really any other timelines. I mean, it's just that it's really sort of the first time that they've done something like that. So I hope it continues with that in mind and that they can regard that as like this sort of box set of Bond films and that we can, you know, start with another actor and not have to tie it in or rationalize it with anything that occurred during the Craig era. That's my hope.
And have you got any names in the frame or you'd like to see particularly?
Oh, do you know, it's like every time that I see a new name in the press about who might be the next Bond, I mean, so many times it's like, oh no, I would actually like this person in the role, but now that people are talking about it, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I actually really like Aaron Taylor Johnson. I think he's a really good actor and I think he looks the part. I think he's, you know, a good age. you know, to be in the series. I think of the actors, you know, sort of the latest list that I've seen. I think, you know, to me, he would make the most sense to put into the role. I mean, I always really, I'm sorry.
He's not too well known either. He's not, you know, he's on the cusp, isn't he, almost?
Right. And I think, you know, I really like Henry Cavill, but I think that having played Superman and headed up, you know, a franchise like that, I think that diminishes his chance of, you know, being cast in the role. I think Aidan Turner is another great, Sam, as you said, like somebody who's sort of at the right level of public awareness and prominence to be in the role. I mean, it's like people are aware that he's got really good acting chops, but he's not indelibly associated with any particular character already. He was so good in And Then There Were None, that Agatha Christie adaptation.
Oh, yeah, that was brilliant. He was
so good. Yeah.
Charles Dance was in it as well, wasn't he?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That was fantastic. Yeah.
Really enjoyed that. Yeah, I mean, I'm intrigued by a number of them. I've never seen Regé Jean Page in anything, but, you know, I think from what I hear and from what I see, I think he'd be really good in the role. Yeah, I don't know. I'd probably be Aaron Taylor Johnson, but now I'm almost worried that there's too much buzz about him for him to be in the role. I don't know.
But it might be a case of, like we said before, they keep saying we need to decide where the character is going first before they cast. Surely they must have done something since that was sent now. And we do hear rumours that Aaron Taylor-Johnson has been to Pinewood. I mean, I don't know whether that's true. But like I say, there's usually no smoke without fire when it comes to these things. I mean, how exciting is it going to be now? Just anything. You know, like when, for No Time to Die, they announced Danny Boyle. I was like, oh my word, this is brilliant. Not just because he's from Bury, where I'm from, and because I love his films. But it was just, you know, an actual progress, and heck, this is quite a bold, positive move. I'm not as bothered now about announcing the director and everything, because I think I just wish they'd go back to not letting names dictate. And I suppose Cary Fukunaga wasn't, was he? He came in after, although he did have a co-write credit, so, you know, there is some kind of involvement. But you'd rather it be I'd rather it go back to the conveyor belt of the, even going back to Brosnan's. They kept asking the previous director to continue, didn't they, I think? Like Martin Campbell was asked back for Tomorrow Never Dies. Roger Spottiswoode, I think, was asked back. Michael Apted was certainly asked back initially for Die Another Day. I'd rather know what direction they're going in and who is Bond and maybe how many films they're contracted to and how many films you're going to do in 10 years. Not
just one.
No, pointlessly, these big anniversaries. If there's just been one film since the last one, you know. Goodness.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, Sam, who? Anyone in the frame for you? Any direction? Or
it is difficult because I hate speculation of things most of the time. Anyway, just because it could be anyone, and you end up going around in circles, people argue, and ultimately it doesn't amount to anything. It's, you know, I get annoyed when it's like a new Doctor Who, for example, and I'm like, well, actually, that person's not even left the role yet, so maybe, like, let's...
Yeah, I don't like that.
Until they're gone, then we can focus on it. Obviously, it was, I think once everyone knew the end of No Time to Die, I think everyone was like, okay, for sure, he's not coming back, so we can actually think about this a bit more now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I hate to be the same, but I mean, I was at the Albert Hall when that concert was on, and either David or Anthony, one of them said that Aaron Taylor-Johnson had walked past me, like literally... I walked one way, he walked the other way, right past me, and I didn't even notice. And I was like, what? And I think for me, that's the only kind of like thing that would make you think, oh yeah, he's potentially in the running. But at the same time, there's lots of people who go to Pinewood who could have a callback or whatever like that, and it ultimately doesn't work out. So who knows, but it's annoying as well because you see these names and you go, oh yeah, that guy would be great, and oh, they'd be great. And you end up thinking of, unless you think they're not right at all, your kind of mind works and kind of goes, oh, well, actually, that could work if they do this or if they do that. And you're right, Tom, you know, it can depend on what direction they're taking, because they'll get a different kind of answer if they are going to take it in a more kind of Roger Moore-esque or Brosnan type of way, if they're going to stick with a more serious route, then they'll get a more serious, classically trained answer, I guess. But it's just still so open in the air, and potentially a director could help kind of make you go, oh, well, actually, based on what this person's done before, like, I'd actually be interested if they gave films to less experienced directors. Not that I want someone who doesn't know how to do stuff, but you kind of want someone who is going to put their own stamp on it, but also really listen and kind of collaborate with...
With a job.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of, what great experience would it be if you've done some films or you've done some TV and it's okay, now you're getting this next level and it's a Bond film, a part of this new era of what a Bond film could be. I love these fresh takes, and I think you see this a lot in kind of in new TV series that are created on streaming platforms and in some films as well. Like, I know, I think in some like Marvel films now, not that I really watch them, but I think a lot of them have like maybe some less experienced directors or some that are very up and coming. And I'd be more interested in that rather than, you know, someone who's had a very illustrious career and is just kind of like, oh, well, I only do films this kind of way, so I'm going to do that. Obviously, not every director is like that, for sure, and some will adapt very easy. But I think, you know, some of the Craig films for me have kind of been watered down because of how much influence the director has had. And Tom, I know you've spoken about that with the guys a lot. You know, I don't want to kind of discredit the work that they've done, because it's a lot of work and, you know, it's a lot of pressure for a director. But if I was a director, I would want my own stamp on something. I wouldn't want it to just be a film that I worked on and isn't, my part of me isn't in it. So I can understand them really wanting to, but when it's a franchise like this, I think there's a very good balance of your own stamp plus the formula of Bond. And I think that worked for a very long time with so many different people behind the scenes, different people in front of the camera, and it worked. So I think let's try that again. Yeah, why not? Sure. What could go wrong? It's been 20-odd years since that happened. So
until more recently, every Bond film's had the same, you know, gun barrel, pre-title sequence, Bond with the ladies, completing the mission, villain, henchmen, casinos, action scenes, stunts. That sounds like a lot to fit in if you're coming in with completely fresh eyes, but how much variety have all those Bond films got? And yet they've all got those things in them. Mm-hmm. So it can be done. I mean, the poles apart, aren't they? Moonraker and Dr. No, you know, they completely different style of films. And there's ones in between. There's, you know, our favourite John Glenn. He's got all of them in the same film, hasn't he? From every single sort of tone, he's in the same film. And it somehow works. And I think they've just got to trust the audience a bit, that the audience will be with them, certainly this next one. Mm. Yes, social media is an absolute nightmare. It'll be even worse now. If they don't like this Bond, it'll be 10 times worse probably for them before they've seen the film. I've already promised to myself that even if it's someone who I probably wouldn't have chosen myself, I'm going to completely back them and just be really positive and look forward to it as a new era and a new set of films, hopefully. And films as well. I know people have talked about it might be nice to have a sort of TV series set in the era the novels were, but they did it with, they waited and waited for No Time to Die, didn't they? Because it was a cinematic experience. And the box office shows they were right to do that rather than put it out in 2020 when Tenet came out, that kind of time. So we are going to get cinema experiences, because Amazon, even though they're involved, they've not really been interfering, as far as I know, too much yet. Hopefully they'll interfere to say, can you get on with this, guys? Can you get a film out as soon as possible?
Well, I mean, it looks like, I mean, everyone said about Michael G. Wilson taking a step back, and I think, is it his son taking...
Yeah, Greg.
Yeah. And I've seen him do some things. I've seen his name pop up more, and I actually didn't even know what he looked like until a few months ago, because he was on something. I was like, oh, right, okay. So I think... You know, I think it's, you also forget how long Barbara and Michael have really been running the show. I mean, I would say since GoldenEye, because Kirby was kind of mostly out of action on that anyway. So it has been.
It's longest, isn't it, now?
Yeah, it's almost 30 years.
Yeah.
So I think new blood is always needed. And for something to survive, it's got to keep going, and you need to kind of eventually pass it over. And I think that this is the thing that we've got to be excited about. And you're right, Tom, we need to kind of, I think, pulled together, because it's so easy. It's so easy for someone to write a comment or to just say, oh, this is going to be crap, this is rubbish. You know, you get, it's awful for actors and for filmmakers nowadays, because one wrong thing that looks bad, then everyone's on them, and it's like death threats and just stupid things like that, which some people will write and they'll think, oh, it's nothing, I'm just writing a tweet. But it can cause a lot if there's hundreds of people doing that same thing. We've given time for this series before, and we can do it again, especially for when it's entering a new era. You know, hopefully we'll get new games, some new merch, maybe some series. Maybe that's not directly related to the films. Yeah. I think the films have a level of prestige that need to kind of be uninterrupted. But I think there's ways to adapt this James Bond world without actively affecting what the purpose of the films are. So just keeping my fingers crossed that we get something, at least some news this year. I would like some news this year. It's January. We've got time.
I feel like I want to quote Dr. Evil, say, throw us a frickin' bone.
Where's the sharks with laser beams on their freaking heads? Like, don't do that. We don't want that in the new film, but I mean, I'd be kind of intrigued by that as well. But get Michael Caine.
Yeah. Can't believe he's not been in a Bond film, really. Because he was best mates with Sean and Roger as well.
I know, you see that hero stories.
And he was in the Fourth Protocol, famously. Oh, dear. This is fantastic, guys. I am still excited, and I'm not at the stage where I'm clicking refresh every day. I'm expecting some news. When it happens, we're all going to be excited, and we're all going to sort of, that'll give us a new lease of life, because it's been a bit weird to celebrate the 60th anniversary with Bond perished, you know, and it's the first time ever there's been no actor representing the franchise, isn't it, really? Because until you get replaced, that's it. You know, you're still Bond. Tim was still technically Bond until 94. But now, I know Craig's done a few things, hasn't he? He's done a few things, sort of going to events with Barbara and Michael, but technically...
Infamous adverts.
Yeah, but that's more like a two fingers up at Bond, that. It's like, great, I don't have to be Bond anymore.
Someone's ringing a bell out there for boxing. Someone will enter the ring and fight you on it. I'm not going
to
do it.
It's time to go, Tom. Yeah. We do look forward to the next Bond and the next press conference. That'll be fascinating, won't it? You know, in this age of Bond's social media and everything, because, like you say, 2006, there was none of that, really, was there, anywhere near this level. That'll be out and a massive event. I mean, some people might be able to go to it personally. Thank you, guys. It's been a wonderful discussion. I've really enjoyed it. Great to meet you, Charlie.
Oh, this was great. It was great to spend some time with you guys and talk about Bond. Yeah, this is really fun. Thank you.
It's great to have a really passionate, positive Bond fan. And you're so good. And like I say, if you don't know Charlie on Instagram, Charloid, was it 0926?
That's right.
Hey, you are.
That's right.
You're all right then, didn't I? And Sam is also on social media, aren't you?
I'm about, you know, I'm here and there. I'm everywhere, I'm sure. But
thanks for listening, everybody. And we look forward to unveiling the news when the next Bond is announced. But until then, been really, really great having you both, guys. And good night, sir.
Really, Douglas.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.